increased at 7. Humidity is high at 83%. Sunny and 61 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We want to remind you of Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive currently underway. Please take a moment, if you can, to contribute online at www.wpr.org, or you can call them toll-free at 1-888-202-2552. And when you do so, please mention that you are a listener to WGTD and to The Morning Show. Of all of the creatures on Earth, there's maybe no creature more beautiful than a horse. And horses also, for as, in a sense, commonplace as they are also creatures of, in a sense, some mystery to most of us. And one person who understands horses in a very, very profound way is Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. And Dr. Hamilton, in addition to his work as a very successful neurosurgeon, I believe, has also for a quarter of a century worked closely with and trained horses. And he has come to a very, very deep understanding of what is important to horses, of the way that they learn, the way that they interact with one another, the way they see the world. And he's come to understand a number of different lessons that we can learn from horses. And these are lessons that can be applied to many different facets of our daily lives. And I'm really excited to be able to speak with Dr. Hamilton about his very, very intriguing book. He's also the author of a previous book called Zen Mind, Zen Horse. And by the way, he was a medical script consultant for the hit television series Grey's Anatomy. So Dr. Hamilton is a busy, busy man, but I'm glad his busy schedule allowed him to write this really interesting book and to join me on the morning show to talk about it. The book is published by Story Publishing. Again, it's called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. Dr. Alan J. Hamilton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me, Greg.
Glad to be talking with you. It's a beautiful book, and it's beautiful in terms of its content and also just in its appearance as well. I have to say this book visually is sort of a work of art. Can you just say a word about that?
Well, I was very pleased. Story put a lot of resources and artwork in it to sort of make it into more like a gift book, if you will. But they did a beautiful, beautiful job, and the artwork is just by a wonderful artist named Robert Farkas, and he's just these spectacular drawings, and so it makes for a beautiful gift, even if you're not a horse person. As you said, it's about 112 lessons, and that you can apply to your life in general.
And it's a book that's just over 200 pages long, so it's not a massive book, and these are short little chapters. They are easily read, easily digested, but they give us so much to think about. And so I really commend you on a job well done.
Oh,
so tell us when you first began working with horses. When and why did that happen?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll tell you the brief version. I was I came from a home where there was domestic violence, and my father was physically abusive, and my grandfather and my mom left, and my grandfather raised me, and he was a cavalry officer and a very fine equestrian. And so I really, probably genetically, but certainly environmentally, I really got the bug. And I started teaching, riding at summer camp when I was a counselor. And it just kept going deeper and deeper. And I've been training horses here in the States and abroad for the last quarter of a century. And I have to say, I just sort of keep going back to the well for me. I just find that horses are wonderful teachers about life lessons. And, I'm kind of dumb in some ways, and I think the horses are just sitting there very patiently going, don't worry, he'll come around, don't worry, he'll come around, he'll see the light. So I kind of think of them as these sages, out in the pastures that are sort of, waiting, going, oh, we'll see, grasshopper, if you're ready, So it's been a lifelong project, and ever since I can remember, I've been nuts about horses. So it's it's in my blood.
Right. So explain, for instance, at this moment in time, how many horses do you have, and what kind of place do they occupy in your daily life?
So we have some of my own horses, and I've raised Lipizzans, which are these beautiful dressage horses, and then a number of people bring horses to us for training, for 30, 60, or 90 days. And we have a beautiful setting here in the desert with very lush pastures. Actually, it's kind of surprising and shocking when you think you're in the desert, but this is in a very low-lying aquifer, so there are beautiful trees and everything else. And, sort of horse heaven. And I have to say, I have a lot of help training horses, and I always say, I get up in the middle of the night and start working the horses at like 5 a.m. And then I go to work and I do my, my daily work as a brain surgeon. And then I kind of crawl home in the evening, have dinner, maybe go out under the lights and work the horses again. And, occasionally a weekend and that sort of thing. But I kind of jam it all in so that the horses are getting worked every day, 5-6 days a week kind of thing. But it's very fulfilling, I have to say. And even my wife sometimes will say, okay, why don't you just finish up and go out with the horses, because it's pretty clear you need to go there and spend some time with them. So I know I'm in trouble when she sends me out to work the horses. But it is very soothing on the soul. And as I said, they have passed on wonderful life lessons. Sometimes I wish I had learned them earlier in life, but I'm always grateful whenever, I finally get the lesson from the horse.
This book feels like something that did not spring into being overnight. I'm curious at what point in time you began actually working on this book versus how long have these lessons been sort of learned over the course of time?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Greg, because it's funny you should say that. The way this started out was with, those little golf pencils that people take when they play golf, those tiny little pencils.
Right.
This started off with like some 3x5 cards in the back pocket of my jeans and a golf pencil. And I would sort of go off and I just would make some notes as I was riding. And I would put the back in my pocket and just kind of refer them and keep them in the barn and, kind of stick them back in and add some more, and it would go on like that. And I would say probably 5 or 6 years like that. And I began to see that as I would go back to some of the earlier cards, I would begin to see that there was kind of a progression through it. And originally my idea was, I'll make something that somebody could just stick in their back pocket. But story publishing began to put the book together, they really had some very good ideas about how to make it thematically and make it more applicable to every person's life rather than just horsey people, as we say. And that's sort of how it evolved. I had written Zen Mind, Zen Horse, and I thought, well, I'm done. But then I saw, no, wait a minute. There's more of a progression, and it's getting deeper and deeper. And it was really on these cards for a very long time before we started thinking about how do we transfer it to a book.
Hmm. So one of the most interesting things about the book is the way it's laid out in these various sections. And I really, really appreciate that it's not just a big long laundry list of lessons, but lessons that sort of coalesce around different themes. And one of them being teaching, and another being leadership, and another being around just finding more mindfulness in life. Now, is that more the hand of an editor, kind of sorting out these lessons into these themes, or is that something that began to occur to you as well?
No, that began to occur to me as I started. As I said, I started, going through and seeing a progression, and I started clumping them, and then I began to realize that I could take two or three of these index cards and put them together, and they made, and I would give them a title, and then start, taking what I had on the 3x5 cards. So each of these titles was sort of already one lesson, and it might have been two or three or five cards that I then condensed down into, one page or half a page essay. But that's really how it came about. And then we ended up with 112 lessons.
Hmm. Let's start with the beginning of the book, in which the section is called Teaching and Learning. And this is actually probably a really good place to begin, because in a sense, this springs so directly out of the work that you have done as a trainer of horses, about what real teaching is, what real learning is, and about the ways in which we can kind of draw from these interactions that you've had with horses over the years. One of the most important things that you tell us is that you treat each of these horses as an individual. And you caution teachers to think in a similar way, that the idea of one size fits all is going to be almost certainly detrimental to good teaching taking place.
I think we all do teaching. We're not aware of it, but as parents we do teaching. Sometimes as spouses we teach each other. And I think for me, I teach at a major university and have taught all my life. But the thing there about when you approach a new horse for training is you have to figure out where is that individual horse. There's not going to be any recipe. You're going to have to sort out exactly what that horse is used to, exactly what that horse feels comfortable with. And some horses, are more playful. Other horses are more looking for affection. Other horses are I was looking at you were the son of a Lutheran minister, and so it's sort of kind of a Lutheran work ethic is a lot of quarter horses have that sort of work ethic. So you sort of look for each horse and you try and get a feel for their personality, and they're doing the same for you. They're much faster at reading us than we are reading them. A horse will read a human being in 20, 30 seconds. But for me, with the horse, I'm moving them around. I'm trying to see how they want to come to me, how they want to move away from me, what seems to motivate them. Are they more motivated by, kind of the reward of doing something and then getting that affection? Or are they more rewarded by sort of coming into my circle and being able to stand next to me and me able to reinforce with them that, hey, when you stand next to me, you're going to have a quiet, tranquil, peaceful, soft partner. So I think the same thing happens with students, and I think, for example, one of the things I've never quite understood is that you can go into the first grade and you can ask first grade children, how many of you in this class are artists? And 90% of the hands will go up. You take that same class and go into the sixth grade and ask the same question, and less than 10% of the hands go up. So we've eliminated the artists virtually. And the same thing is true of horses. You don't want to eliminate the artist. You want that individual personality and creativity and verve and enthusiasm. You want it to be there. And you kill it when you just try to apply a method blindly. And I think, you know, this that with our children, what we want to do is have them have the feel for maximal creativity, the sense of being maximally immersed in what they're doing and getting tremendous self-gratification out of it. So, you know, it's sort of the same thing. If we approach our kids as individuals, we will keep the artist alive. And the equivalent of that in the horse is that you keep the horse's personality completely alive and intact, and you don't dull it with drills and schedules and kind of a recipe style of training, but really individualized for what that horse's strengths and weaknesses are.
Right. I appreciated in this section of the book, I mean, so many things, because I happen to be a teacher as well, and I'm married to a teacher.
I
especially appreciated the section where you talk about cultivating a beginner's mind. I appreciated this because I find teaching at the collegiate level that this is one of the hardest things, that by the time a young man or a young woman is 18, 19, 20 years old, they don't want to be a beginner at anything. So if they are learning to sing their first song in French or having to take the very first piano lessons they've ever taken in their entire life, by and large, that is an awkward and difficult position for them to find themselves in as a beginner at such an advanced age, in a sense. And I loved how this chapter kind of turns that on its head, and you make the state of being a beginner a wonderful thing, a moment full of promise.
Yeah, I think, you know, the beginner's mind has to be both in the teacher and the student. I think that's what you sort of learn from horses, which is don't approach the horse or the student, you know, that where you're confident in what you know and you're the expert, but instead, you know, you want to keep an open mind. And that means that you are looking at the possibilities. You're not, so for example, with a horse, you're not limited to thinking about what you think should happen with the horse in terms of the training. You want to really come at it with, I don't know all the possibilities of how this horse learns or what this horse is capable of, but I'm going to be completely open to anything that's going to be happening. And I don't set limits by my own expectations. Oh, you know, this horse is going to be a good hunter jumper, or this is going to be a good Western pleasure. And the same thing happens with students, I think. We go in, you know, and we think, well, we're the teacher, we're the professor, whatever, and we have this a schedule or you know, curriculum that we think is has to be taught. And part of that problem is you're not coming in with a beginner's mind. You're not open to the possibility that the students may take you to some place you didn't expect, that surprised you, and that actually you know, interested you. And I think the more I teach, the longer I teach, the more I realize that the students have, in some ways, a lot more to teach me than I have to teach them, but I have to keep the beginner's mind there. So, for example, I might not be as digitally gifted in social media as my students are, but I want to have a beginner's mind that they are going to open my eyes to all of the different possibilities. So I think it's that, you know, horses teach you from the get-go that the more of an agenda that you have, the more you constrain the outcome.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Alan J. Hamilton about his book, Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. There are so many other good points that you make in this particular section of the book, including some very, very thoughtful words about the importance of patience. I wonder if you could say a word about the importance of correction or reprimanding. Because I think you speak really, really interestingly on this topic. Just talk about your guiding principles when it comes to correcting a horse or reprimanding it, and how applicable you think those principles are to the correcting or reprimanding that we need to do in our own lives and interacting with other humans.
Well, I think that we, you know, first the horses have taught me a great deal, and I have to say, I wish they had taught it to me a little sooner, because I think I would have been a better parent for it. I think the horse is much more motivated by the positive part of correction than by the harsher punishment, if you will. And we have a natural tendency to think that negative reinforcement works, you know. But in fact, you know, one thing psychology, and I'm married to a clinical psychologist, so one of the things is that psychology has said over and over and over again is negative reinforcement does not work that well. So one of the things that I look for with the horse is I want to correct him, but I don't want to punish him. And so what I'm looking for is my job is to make it as easy for him to succeed as possible. And sometimes people say, well, that's cheating, you know, because I'll say, well, let's work on the horse standing still when he's really tired. And they go, well, of course he's going to stand still when he's tired. And I go, well, that's my point. It's going to make it very easy for me to teach him the skill. So, you know, I think I always say, think about teaching like skiing. When it's good skiing and it makes it easy for the student, it's like skiing downhill. And when the horse is trying not to do, is sort of going in the wrong direction, I make it like skiing uphill. So I'm always motivating the horse to look for the easiest way to learn the task and make it easy for him to succeed. And I think that's another thing that I say in the book. We don't reward frequently enough. We don't. I have a saying in my barn, which is, you know, ask for a lot, settle for less, and reward frequently. We have to spend more time in our lives at work, in our lives with our family, our lives with our friends, making people understand that we are rewarding them, we're appreciating what they're doing. And, you know, I think my mantra when I'm training horses is pause, pet, breathe. And that's after everything that I do with the horse, every single movement, I'll pause, pet, and breathe. So I send that horse a signal with my body that I'm taking a breath and I'm relaxing, but I'm also petting him because I'm saying, hey, thank you for doing that for me.
Hmm.
And I think we don't reward frequently enough.
Right. I like the very simple two-word title of that chapter, Reward Abundantly.
Yeah.
A couple other lessons I want to ask you about. One of them is really intriguing. I should say some of these lessons, in a sense, are on the surface relatively obvious, although I think in almost every single case, you go beyond the obvious and share some insights that take us beyond the obvious and the inevitable. And then there are some cases in which you, for instance, draw distinctions between terms that I've never heard drawn before. For instance, in the section of the book about leading and following, when you draw a distinction between idleness and stillness, explain why this distinction is so important.
Well, I think that you know, you have to think about, people tend to think that, you know, being out there in the round pen where it's sort of a physical equivalent, I think that's what makes it to me so easy with horses, is it's not just not moving. A lot of people think it's just not moving your feet and not being, but it's not. It is good trainers use their energy very eloquently, and they use it very sparingly. And so what they want to do is not overwhelm the horse with dominance or power or, you know, might is right, but instead get as quiet as they can and use the least amount of energy as possible, and calling the least amount of attention to yourself. And keeping the attention focused on the horse. And I have another section where I go, self praise stinks. and that is, you know, in life, don't call attention to yourself. Call attention to others. Call attention to the people who are the focus of what you're doing. And real power is born out of stillness. There's great power in quietness, and I'll give you an example from my professional life. which seems very far afield from the round pen and training horses. When I go to a code, okay, when we're resuscitating a patient, I want to walk in with my body as quiet and peaceful as possible, and I want my voice to be soft. And the reason is I want my team to understand I'm not panicking, okay? I'm nice and quiet, and I lower my voice so they have to listen, because as I do that, I quiet the whole room down, and I get everybody thinking about this patient and getting our job done and not letting the adrenaline run away with us. And so, you know, again, it's that real power, real leadership comes out of quiet stillness, not out of exuberant displays of energy.
A couple other interesting ideas include this phrase, the curve of compromise. That is so beautiful, even before we read the chapter and kind of learn more about what's behind those intriguing words. And it seems to me that in this day and age in which we live, this is one lesson that a whole lot of us need to learn. Talk about the curve of compromise.
We're predators. The horse is the prototypic prey animal, but we're predators. We go directly at what we want, and we tend to apply our energy to that object. So in the equivalent of a horse, that means when we want the horse to leave and lead, you know, follow us, we pull on that lead rope. Okay, but the real problem is, yes, you have a 1,200-pound horse on the end of your lead rope, but the other way of looking at it is the 1,200-pound horse has you on the end of the lead rope. And if you start creating resistance, which is what we do as predators, then the horse starts to create resistance, and you have to say to yourself, what chance do I really have against a 1,200-pound horse? The answer is none. If that horse makes up their mind, they're not going to do what you want. So instead of escalating those lines of resistance with the lead rope, what I encourage people to do when I'm training them with their horses is have the horse turn on a curve and flow with you, okay, because it makes it much easier for the horse to move out. So I said, look in your life. Where are you at work or at home creating lines of resistance which only encourage escalation? And instead, look for flow, look for a curve of compromise where you can walk off in a partnership. And It's much gentler, it's much more elegant, and the real thing that happens is the horse is moving out of his own volition. There's no application of force. And I think, you know, you can apply this in your own life, but you could just as easily say, let's apply this in politics, where we are constantly creating lines of resistance as opposed to looking where the areas are that we can create curves of compromise.
I wonder if you could say a word about the words that open this section of the book where you talk about the best kind of leader. This is also something that in the times in which we live and this particular season in which we find ourselves, that this is important for us to consider. What do you see? What have you learned from your horses in terms of the most important characteristics of great leadership?
The thing to remember with the horses is they're a herd. They see themselves not just as individuals, but much more as a we than a me. And what they're looking for is usually it's the alpha male who's running the herd, and they're looking for an alpha male that has what I call the four C's of leadership, which is really command, control, communication, and compassion. They need a leader who's going to keep the herd safe and understands how to move that herd to safety very quickly if there's a predator or a threat. So they need to be able to command the herd quickly, control where the horses stand, but that leader also puts themselves at risk. That leader is the one that confronts the threat and tells the herd whether it's safe for them to move on. So they have to be able to communicate that, and then they have to have compassion in the sense that they have to put the good of the herd, the good of the we, before anything else. It doesn't do them any good to say, well, there's just enough feed for me and the rest of the herd can stay behind. That's not how they think. They'll be saying, is there enough for all of us? Is there enough to support? Is there enough browse? Is there enough water? And so the idea of the leader is you earn the leadership position from the herd every day by demonstrating that you put their interests before your own, that you encounter the threats, that you put yourself at risk, and you are displaying the four C's of leadership.
I want to finish by saying that one of the things I especially appreciated about your book is the beautifully written acknowledgments. And beyond thanking your grandfather, whom you've already talked about in this interview, and thanking, of course, the horses, including those with whom you've felt really close, I think you do a really beautiful job of acknowledging the support that you've received both from your wife, Jane, and from your three children. I think, if I understand correctly, none of them, in your words, have been bitten by the horse bug. But they have not only not stood in the way, but they have really respected this facet of your life and the measure of devotion that you've shown to your horses. Just talk for a moment about how important this has been to you.
Well, I think there's a group, I think when comedians die, they go up to heaven, and there's like a cosmic dead comedians club, and they meet, and they sort of say, what would be really funny is we'll get this guy who's just totally in love with horses, and then what we'll do is we'll embed him in a family that he loves, but nobody in the family cares anything about horses, and let's see what happens, okay? And so you're here's my family living at this ranch, filled with horses. I remember one morning I had a pony for my daughter outside her window when she was about 11 with a big bow on it. And I said, happy birthday, sweetheart. And I pulled open the blinds, and she saw this pony, and she looked at it, and she looked back, and she said, Dad, where are my birthday presents? So it was one of these things, and I think that it would have been very easy for my family to have poo-pooed everything, to have they also, gave up a lot for us to live on the ranch and to see me, really putting a lot of my time and resources into horses. And I think they just understood that this was much more, a real spiritual pursuit for me. And I think they supported me in it. And really were there for me.
I really encourage people to check out this book and to read it thoroughly, as I have, because it gave me so much to think about, and so much to think about in just about all of the different walks of my own life, professionally and personally as well. And I just can't give a higher compliment to a book than that. The book, again, is called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses, published by Story Publishing, featuring the beautiful illustrations of Robert Farkas and the sensitive writing of Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. Dr. Hamilton, I really have enjoyed our conversation and very much appreciate your book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Greg, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. It's 8:43. We talk today about fear. But more important even than talking about fear, we will talk about some ways in which you can confront any fear issues which you might have in your life. And a lot of people have fear issues, in fact. Some statistics suggest fully one quarter of all Americans have or will have what we would call an anxiety disorder. And as our guest, Dr. David Tolan, is going to explain, this makes it a problem which actually dwarfs things such as depression or substance abuse. I mean, there are so many of us walking around with these issues, and in many cases with issues so severe that our lives are adversely affected, and the lives of those around us, those we care about and who care about us. Dr. David Tolan is a well-known psychiatrist, and director and founder of the Institute of Living, and specifically at the Anxiety Disorders Center. And some of his colleagues there have collaborated with him in his most recent book, which is called Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions, a book published by John Wiley and Sons. Dr. Tolan is taking aim at a very important and complex topic, and trying to help us come to terms with the role that excessive fear might have in our lives. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak with him. And by the way, the name Dr. David Tolan may be familiar to you from some different television programs he has been associated with, such as the OCD Project and the A&E series Hoarders. And he's been on a lot of other programs as well, sharing his expertise. Dr. David Tolan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Nice to be with you.
Look forward to this very much. I was really staggered by the statistic quoted in your book, that one that I mentioned about a quarter of Americans having, or at some point in their lives, having an anxiety disorder. I wonder if you could just say a word about how much this is a peculiarly American phenomenon.
You know, I wish I could say that it was, but it actually turns out that this is a worldwide phenomenon, and this has been detected, by the World Health Organization, who, lists, their leading causes of illness-related disability. And time again, anxiety disorders rank right up there near the top. This really is the most common mental health problem in the United States and probably worldwide, both in terms of the number of people who suffer from them, as well as to the economic impact of those disorders.
One of the things you do in your book is you express some reservations. I almost said disdain. I think that's would be putting it a bit too strongly. But you have some reservations about the way in which fear is often discussed, and particularly the way in which it is often categorized in rather what appears to be very sophisticated scientific fashion. And you actually lay out your book acknowledging those categorizations, but actually choosing to talk about this in your own terms, in categories which you describe as, in a sense, simpler and maybe kind of more intuitive. Talk a moment about your concerns about the way we frame our discussions and understandings of fear and what you've done in this book instead.
Sure. Well, we get the names for these disorders from a volume that comes out every few years that's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. It's published by the American Psychiatric Association, and in the anxiety disorders, it lists a number of diagnoses. And these might be things that people have heard of before. They're things like panic disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, phobias. And those labels are fine. But if you are trying to do something about the problem, they don't necessarily lend themselves very well to kind of intuitively understanding what it is that you need to do. So I thought really what makes much more sense is to break fear down into what the person is afraid of and why. And what we see is that those categories are much fewer in number, and they overlap across various things that are within the anxiety disorders, as well as in some things that are not listed in the anxiety disorders, but I think perhaps should be.
I love the fact that your book actually opens with a brief little anecdote about yourself, mm-hmm. something to the effect that as you were penning those particular words, you happened to be on an airplane, mm-hmm. and freely acknowledge a bit of anxiety of your own in that moment. I don't remember if you were in takeoff or landing or in mid-flight, but I wonder if you could just say a word about your real-life experiences with fear.
Sure. Well, it was kind of fortuitous because I was having writer's block. I knew the book that I wanted to write, and I was on an airplane at the time, and I had my laptop open, and I was sitting here racking my brain thinking, I know what I want to write, but I don't know how to start the book. What do I write? And then all of a sudden the captain comes on and says, we're about to experience severe turbulence, buckle up. And the plane started, you know, pitching, and I, you know, paid attention to what I was thinking and feeling and doing on that flight, and then thought, ah, I think I know how I'm going to start the book. And I just started by describing what was happening to me on this flight. Now, I'm not a phobic of flights, but I was experiencing fear, which is a universal human emotion. It's my guess is that most of the people on the plane were experiencing that to some degree. But I broke it down into talking about what does that mean biologically, what happens to the body when somebody experiences fear, and I talked about what happens mentally when somebody is experiencing fear, what kinds of things do they think about and how do they think and process information, and then I talked about it behaviorally. So what does somebody do when they feel anxious as a way of trying to feel better, and does that work or does that contribute to the problem? And it turns out that actually the very kinds of experiences I was having there on that airplane in turbulence are precisely the same things that we talk to our anxiety disordered patients and clients about. We talk to them about what those bodily sensations mean and the role of your thinking and your own actions in causing the fear to persist.
I wonder, as you put this book together, what sorts of pitfalls you wanted to avoid, because you acknowledge the fact that mountains of books about fear have been written, some of which you find to be well-written books and
sure,
worthwhile books, and which you, I think, acknowledge even more specifically. But there's also been a lot of poor and not particularly helpful stuff written about fear.
Right.
What were you most anxious to avoid as you put this book together?
I was trying to strike a balance here. And as you mentioned, Greg, there are a lot of really very well-written self-help books about how to deal with anxieties and fears and anxiety disorders. And I'm a big fan of them, and I even recommend them by name in the book. However, the problem with those is generally that they are too narrow. That is, they only are written to apply to one very specific DSM anxiety disorder. And they don't tell you what to do about other forms of anxiety. And the problem is, of course, most people with anxiety disorders actually have multiple kinds of anxiety. They have multiple fears. So unless you want to buy an entire shelf worth of books, it's very hard to find one comprehensive guide that sort of tells you how to do it. Now, the other books that are out there that are broadly written, that is, they're written to help people with anxiety disorder, many of them are chock full of misinformation and actually could steer readers down the wrong path into things that I think are frankly unhelpful, at the very least don't have any scientific support behind them, or in some cases may even be harmful or dangerous.
Speaking of that, your book includes a questionnaire in which the reader is invited to answer a number of different questions about themselves and the sorts of things which set off their own fears. And it helps a reader to potentially place themselves within the framework of the different types of fear that you address.
Mm-hmm.
But what I especially appreciate about your questionnaire are sort of the points of clarification which follow it, because it underscores the fact that any kind of a questionnaire, no matter how carefully you put it together, is still a relatively blunt and not all that sophisticated sort of instrument,
mm-hmm,
that so easily can be misused. I mean, that, for instance, somebody can end up convincing themselves that they have a terribly serious disorder, or
mm-hmm,
or in other ways, I mean, act on the questionnaire and its results in an inappropriate way. I so
yeah,
appreciate the fact that you have, in a sense, some disclaimers and some points of clarification that really will help the reader, I think, to use this questionnaire properly.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'm really steering away from, and I think it's in the spirit of the whole program, is I'm steering away from trying to diagnose people. It doesn't mean there's no place for diagnosis in the business, but in this context, you know, I didn't want people to come up with, you know, read the questionnaire and come away thinking, aha, this questionnaire tells me I have OCD, because that's not really an appropriate role for a you know, self-administered questionnaire. If you really want to be diagnosed and know what the DSM label for your condition is, you have to go and talk to a specialist. However, if the issue is that you're experiencing fear, then all we need to do is start to understand what kind of fear that is. And so that's really what the questionnaire is aiming to do. And from there, we break it down, and people can categorize themselves into one or more of several categories of fear. These are not diagnoses. These are just descriptive statements about what are you afraid of. And some people are afraid of specific situations or objects or activities. Now, this could be things like, you know, snakes, spiders, high places, you know, elevators, and so on. Some people are afraid of body sensations. That is, they're afraid of physiological sensations that come from inside their body, which they then believe to mean something, you know, is very medically wrong, or that they're going to have a disastrous attack of some kind. And some people will have social and performance fears. That is, they're primarily afraid of having to interact or perform in front of other people, and they're afraid that they're going to be humiliated or embarrassed. And there are some people who have excessive worrying. That is, they tell themselves nightmare scenarios about bad things that could happen in the future. And finally, there are some people who have what we might call post-traumatic fears. That is, they develop fears because something awful happened to them, and part of what they start to become afraid of are the memories of the event itself. And by simply using that framework, it helps lead the reader to what I think is a much more intuitive plan for, well, if I can categorize my fear this way, then I can develop a step-by-step plan to show me exactly what I need to do about it.
We're speaking with Dr. David Tolan and talking about his book, Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions. The bedrock of what you write about in your book is exposure therapy, which is a means by which, in careful fashion, someone ultimately is exposed to that to which they are so fearful, in a careful process of sort of realizing life doesn't end, the ceiling doesn't crash in, you know, just because you hold that piece of soap or whatever it is that is causing you such anxiety. Mm-hmm. You tell us that exposure therapy is woefully underutilized in clinical practice.
Yeah.
Why would that be?
Well, I think that there's several reasons for it, and one of which is that it is still not nearly as widely taught to mental health practitioners as would be reasonable. You know, we are still, I think that what we're seeing is kind of the dawning of a new age in mental health care, one that is much more carefully and rigorously based on the science of human emotion and cognition and behavior. I think what we end up with is for a lot of mental health practitioners, what is being taught and used is not terribly scientifically valid, and what is scientifically valid tends not to be taught and used. You know, and so what you find actually is that when you go to a mental health professional, and that could be a psychologist, it could be a psychiatrist, a social worker, a licensed professional counselor. If you have an anxiety disorder, the two most likely things you are likely to get are talking therapy and medications. Those are the most commonly used treatments. And the fact of the matter is that the medications are okay, but probably not great. The talking therapy really hasn't been shown to help all that much with anxiety disorders. It may feel good to go and talk to a counselor, but in terms of actually making the anxiety disorder get better, it doesn't seem to do that. There are actually some things you need to do in order to overcome a fear, and those principles are rooted in exposure therapy. You have to disrupt the cycle of avoidance and start to confront successfully the things that you're afraid of.
As is your book, Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions, published by John Wiley and Sons. Dr. David Tolan, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing this book. I can see how it would be tremendously helpful to many, many people. I'm glad we could discuss it today on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I am honored to be speaking with Dr. Richard Seertsma, a longtime member of the music faculty at Carthage College. Now retired, he is going to be honored this weekend at Carthage's homecoming festivities. And we will